This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Hi, friends and listeners. I'm Henrik Pandi, and welcome back to the program. The program examining everything from conspiracies to consciousness, and of course from various different perspectives. Thank you for tuning in today, wherever you are around the world. Radio, news, and much more for you at RedIceCreations.com, our website. Today we have Lauren Coleman with us. He has been an instructor, associate professor, research associate, and documentary filmmaker in various academic university settings since 1980. Lauren has written extensively in the social sciences, having authored, co-authored, or edited several books, including the critically acclaimed Suicide Clusters. His latest book, The Copycat Effect, How the Media and Popular Culture Trigger the Mayhem in Tomorrow's Headlines, is what we are going to focus on today. And of course, keeping the discussion around James Holmes and the shootings in Aurora, Colorado. He'll discuss suicide clustering, twilight language, and harmonic dates and names. He shares his interesting analysis covering synchronicities, patterns, and oddities in relation to the Aurora shooting and James Holmes, which he refers to as a Red Dawn event. Welcome to the program, Lauren Coleman. Finally, we get you on the show. We've wanted to talk to you for a long time now. It's great to have you with us. It's just very, of course, unfortunate that it's over another one of these horrible shooting sprees, massacre. But in any regard, it's good to talk to you, Lauren. So thank you again for coming on.
Well, it's finally good to be here. Although, of course, it's horrible, the circumstances that we do enjoy talking about this because, of course, the media doesn't want to hear about it. So it's shows like yours that really highlight the important information.
Indeed. Thank you for that, Lauren. This is a very important topic. You've written about this in The Copycat Effect, your book from 2004, I believe.
Yes. I've been doing this kind of work in the suicide field for probably 30 years. I wrote a book called Suicide Clusters in 1987 and then followed it up in 2004 with The Copycat Effect, because people were missing the whole point of the copycat contagion factor in all of this.
Is that something you can just tell us a little bit about here in the beginning?
Sure. Well, what we started picking up in terms of working, I was working with teenagers and then older adults, is that there were many suicide clusters in the United States, and then I wanted to do a historical overview, and so I found that going back to, for instance, Vienna in the 1920s and even further back in Russia, and then I tracked it all the way back to the 5th century BC in Greece, that there had been these clusters of suicides, and that they actually had been promoted by people talking about the phenomena of the clustering in the whatever the media was at the time. And it sort of was like dropping a stone in water. The ripples would go out. And the more attention that was paid in a graphic sort of way without any protective factors, then you would get the repeats, the repeating pattern, the copycats, the behavior contagion. And so in 2004, when I wrote my book, that was at a time when we were actually seeing a movement from the suicide clustering across North America and then over into Europe to this move to school shootings. More and more of the suicidal individuals, mostly teenagers and young people who felt suicidal. The other part of suicide, of course, is that if you flip a coin, the other side of suicide is homicide. Homicide, in many of our psychological way of looking at it, is merely suicide pointed outward. And suicide is homicide pointed inward. So there seemed to be this trend and movement from suicides to actual school shootings in which 100% of the time those individuals going into the schools wished to die at the end of the event, either by killing themselves or suicide by cop.
It's just incredible. I'm looking at a Wikipedia thread post on school shootings, and it's actually something that's been going on since the 1700s, going all the way up today. And as you said, these suicide clusters were happening before that. I guess in this case, it's just the difference is that it's weapon involved as opposed to something else. But how can we explain this? What's the reasoning behind this, if any?
Well, what I document in the book, Suicide, Copycat Effect, is that we started seeing a direct link between the more graphic wall-to-wall coverage in the electronic media and then a repeating of that school shooting or clustering of suicides, or now as we see it, it's mass shootings. And you do have, it's more than just shootings. In India, it's around fires. In China and Japan, it's around stabbings. So you do have the clustering and the events that are very violent and repeated coming out in other ways. It's just in North America and Europe, of course, we're very concerned with the guns. So what occurs is you have a report, and all I have to do is look at Columbine or Virginia Tech or Ephraim, Germany, and you have these cases come up, and the media, as opposed to talking about the victims or talking about the collateral damage or how awful it is, or looking for solutions, they immediately go to the place of graphically talking about how many guns were used, what the calibers were, how many people were killed. In other words, looking at it in sort of a entertainment / movie body count kind of description. And then there's always the story that you hear about, well, he was such a nice boy in the neighborhood. He never, you know, he was lonely, or I never talked to him, or things like that. So it's almost as if it's a formula for how these are reported. And yet what we're seeing is in each situation, the next event is in many ways modeled on the previous one with certain add-ons. And I can get into that even more in depth, of course.
Yeah, let's do that. It's interesting what you say, the archetype around this almost that has evolved, an introvert character in many cases, kind of other might think of the person as kind of weird or difficult to get to know or get in contact with. And but again, if we go back to that idea, Lauren, how can we begin to explain this? There are a number of different ways we can approach the subject, and we should talk about these various ones. What is your personal angle on this? How do we explain it? Is this is this the shooter that is basically playing out or replicating what has been seen before? Is that how you would explain this, the reasoning behind it?
Well, I think what we see is, first of all, there's many different ways to explain it, and yet the answer to why for human beings is never satisfactorily answered. But people still try to say, why did this happen? So let's go back a little and look at some of these school shootings, for instance. The school shootings, in many ways, came out of entertainment. A real incident would happen, and then it would be fictionalized in a book like Stephen King's Rage, or a movie like Basketball Diaries, where a school was shot up, or then in Matrix, where the black outfit was sort of added to it, the higher gunpowder, artillery, and all of that was added to it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you start with, though, is if you start with each individual, the individuals that are doing these are slightly mentally ill, but not as psychotic as people would project. They're vulnerable. They're suicidal, they're depressive, and so the classic school shooter was a person that was that way, that they were slightly mentally ill, but not so badly mentally ill that they were losing reality. I think that's one of the intriguing things that we need to look at with Holmes when we get to him and the whole Aurora situation. we may be going into a whole new territory with James Holmes. But back to Columbine and those that happened before Columbine, you had individuals that were angry, that were, you know, teenagers usually, or even the workplace violence or the going postal. Those were people that in many ways wanted to take themselves out, but they were so angry they then decided to take others out. So let me go back to Bailey, Colorado, for instance. Bailey, Colorado was a school shooting that occurred in 2006 and really with over into 2007 with the copycats. So you had already these situations with Columbine where people from the schools or connected to the schools went into the schools and in a fishbowl situation decided to take people out. And it's come out recently, of course, and we knew it back then, that this whole business about the two guys at Columbine were not bullied. They weren't abused. They weren't bullied. That is one of the myths of school shootings that was really put in there by Time magazine and the mass media. In other words, they created a situation, the media did, where they were trying to explain what was going on without hardly any basis in fact of these bullying explanations or other kinds of archetypes and motifs that were put in there.
Mm-hmm.
But what you did have in a very realistic way was the media performing almost an alpha wave projection on the minds of many people how they were going to do their next school shooting. So if you go, let's take Bailey, Colorado. A man goes into school and he decides to line up a bunch of young ladies against the chalkboard and he kills some of them. And what occurred was both the media and the local law enforcement decided to start having news conferences as this drama was unfolding. And this is the imprinting that I really talk about in terms of the twilight language, is that on almost an unconscious level, the media is really in cahoots with the next round of shooters because they're projecting out there in almost a movie-like fashion how the next script should be written. So in Bailey, Colorado, the guy there, because he was afraid the police were going to come in and stop his hostage-slash-school shooting situation, he put chains around the door to lock the police out. This was a rather new addition to the school shootings. But every 5 minutes, every 15 minutes, the local sheriff's department would go out there, and in many ways, he was trying to get himself off the hook. He was saying, we can't go in and save these girls because this guy's chained the door. And then the media would say, well, how is he chaining it? And then the police officer would go into great detail about what was occurring. Well, what we saw is a week later, the Amish shootings in Pennsylvania, the new element that was added to that was the school shooter went into the school and started chaining all of the doors closed.
Hmm.
So what you see is this formula keeps getting added to by each school shooter and is being promoted by the news media. So Virginia Tech, one of the things that I almost immediately heard that was occurring was when Virginia Tech started. You know, there had been earlier in the day a couple killings on campus. The police really didn't respond. And so then this man, Chu, went into the college building and he chained all the doors. So he had, from two previous school shootings, this formula. So what I'm now seeing in Aurora, do you want to go to talk about Aurora or should I explain the twilight language a little bit?
Yeah,
more?
Let's talk about the twilight language first, because I think as we get into James Holmes, this is going to be interesting to keep in mind. So go ahead and do that, Lauren.
Okay, well, as I was writing The Copycat Effect and really very much interested in patterns, there's lots of patterns in terms of the repeating dates. Anniversaries are very important to these school shooters. And in a way that I was trying to assist law enforcement, educators, and other investigators, and mental health professionals who are trying to help these individuals. What I was beginning to see is that the mental health state of the school shooters and the workplace shooters, the mass shooters indeed, they really were working on a temporal framework that is not shared by what let's just call normal people. Anniversaries are very important. Anniversaries of old shootings, anniversaries of their own personal making. And for even we can see among Al-Qaeda, the number 11 keeps being important in their terrorist activity. So I don't see much different in many ways between terrorist activities and school shootings. It's just the difference between the macro level and the micro level. An individual school shooter or workplace bomber can be just as tuned in to the timing as can a global organization like Al-Qaeda that keeps going back to the number 11, doing things on the 11th, doing things on 7, different numbers that are harmonic, and it keeps coming out, even in different languages. So what I started doing in the book, as I was writing about the copycat effect, one of the things that were occurring in the copycat effect was what I was calling the twilight language. If we look back to the Buddhists and other cultures, they often very much would encode their religious messages to each other and their guidelines in a twilight language that you had to be adept at a certain level, very involved in the religion, very involved in the movement, to such a level that only you and those that were parts of the deep, deep cult or organization could understand. And what I started seeing was almost on a very unconscious level, this twilight language about dates was there, and then, of course, about names. There were very, very much some harmonic names, some names that had deeper meanings. A lot of people, of course, go through their whole life, and they don't even look up what their own name means. But, of course, most people who are, naturally narcissistic do look up their own name, and they know what it means, and they know the origins. But they kind of stop there. If they have children, and they're going to name their children, a lot of people, of course, then will look up the name of what their child means. But if you think about what street you live on, what town you're in, different things like that, if you look at some of the copycat phenomena, some of this is really hooking up with a name game, as I call it, on a level that we can never imagine. And am I saying that this is all programmed, that somebody's planning this out? No, I'm saying we don't know, but it is certainly a pattern that's there. So let me just jump ahead to the names Colorado and Aurora. Mm-hmm. If you look at what those mean in Latin and Spanish, Colorado is a name for red, and Aurora is another name, like the god Aurora is another name for dawn. And so I saw the Aurora, Colorado event as a red dawn event, one that is a milestone making, and it's interesting, the name of your show, your organization has red in it, and you understand at some level how red really conveys urgency, change, a real milestone breaking with the past and going into a fiery new beginning.
Right.
So to have the Aurora shooting occur to me signaled that this was not just going to be your normal run-of-the-mill, some workplace shooting with a few people killed and everybody will forget about it tomorrow. And it has become a wall-to-wall event, which CNN today is covering the trial, the court appearance of Holmes. And that keeps occurring over and over again. is these connections with the media and this Red Dawn event.
So, in a way, you're arguing that a child or a young teenager somewhere is sitting and watching this and unconsciously or consciously picking up many of the details as the story is broken apart in the mainstream narrative anyway.
Yeah, and I think we have to look at it at two different levels, of course. There's this programming, and one of the things about my book that really, for some people, it's overwhelming. For other people, it's just a well-documented look at so many of these incidents. I do a chronology in some of these events where, like, a cafeteria shooter has 4 or 5 hours beforehand looked over and over again at a documentary on another cafeteria shooting. And so this imprinting that is occurring by having graphic details on TV does imprint the vulnerable, potentially homicidal next shooter. It's very much going on at a level that the media, and it's very funny because the United States media has trouble with my book, The Copycat Effect. The Canadian media, which has a much more responsible interaction with these events, has not had any trouble with what I'm saying in The Copycat Effect. They understand that, like the Dawson College shooting, which became a wall-to-wall media event across the border in the United States. In Toronto, Canada, they very much didn't want to make the shooter into a celebrity, which occurs so often in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that, of course, a lot of people have a hard time understanding is a lot of people that die by suicide or die in these violent situations, in many ways, have an unrealistic view of death. They think that they're going to live after the event occurs, almost as if they're floating over us as a society, and they want to remember being alive and being celebrated and becoming a folk hero, almost. Even though, of course, all of us hate them, they then translate this hate into respect and being put on a pedestal. And so the media, in the United States at least, certainly propels that into the future. Every time there's one of these school shootings or these workplace or mass shootings, that the individual is made into an enormous media hero. And that's very much a shame. It's really too bad that that does occur.
Is that what you think is driving why it seems, anyway, more and more are doing these types of massacres and shootings, that they, on some level, want to, as you say, become a celebrity or be known? Or what drives this? I mean, this is obviously, not everybody does this, and there must be more reasons, as you say. We know that in some cases they are on SSRI. Some of these kids have a background with certain psychiatrists and medication, and many people, and understandably so, suspect foul play in some way, considering their behavioral patterns, if you will. What's your take on that, Lauren?
Yeah, I think that up to this point, certainly we have seen that over and over again. One of the mistakes that the American TV station NBC made in the Virginia Tech situation is that this shooter had mailed across the board to many media outlets a manifesto, some videos, and he was trying to, after he died, and he thought he was going to die in the Virginia Tech shootings, either by his own hand or by the police, he left behind all of these things that would, so he could have his say. Of course, as I said at the time, and I was quoted in the media saying, to understand what Chu was saying in his manifesto was a fool's game, because a person that is mentally ill and as, just to use the street level word, is as crazy as that, to then think that you're going to learn about his motives or learn about why he's doing this from his written material is really illogical because they're not thinking in an rational mind. Yet what it does is that the next individual that comes along sees, they saw this, they saw MVC putting his picture up there, reading from his manifesto, showing his videotapes, and as you said, he became a celebrity. And the making of celebrities is what the media is all about. So if you're a shooter and you feel like you've had an isolated life, that nobody loves you, we're beginning to learn, for instance, this week that James Holmes saw prostitutes because he had to buy his love. He saw a therapist. That was another way to buy attention and buy love, even though hopefully he was getting some help, but we're beginning to see that the psychiatrist that he picked had some of her own problems. But anyway, back to this whole point is that this model for the next behavior is then put up on a screen like a movie. And one of the, I don't know if you're aware, but I had actually predicted this shooting on the 20th. On the 19th of July, I had written on my blog, The Twilight Language, how I was expecting a major shooting on the 20th connected to the movie The Dark Knight Rises.
Now, break that down for us a bit. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, the way I wrote what I started seeing is I looked back to 2008 and what had happened in 2008 when the Dark Knight originally came out. This motif of the Joker as a psychopathic killer was so powerful to so many people that many violent situations started being copycatted from that movie. So I started breaking this down and looking at it. I don't know if you remember, there was a situation in Belgium where a band named Kim De Gelder went into a daycare center and started stabbing teachers and a baby. He was dressed as the Joker. This occurred on January 23rd, 2009. Now, why is that date significant? Because on January 23rd, 2009, that was when The Dark Knight was reissued around the world on flat screen, you know, on two-dimensional theaters, but more importantly, on IMAX theaters all around the world. So Warner Brothers re-released the film on that day, and here you have a massive situation where, as it turned out, 12 babies were injured, one teacher was killed, two individual infants were killed. And he had red hair, not green hair. He had red hair modeled on the Joker. And he felt that he was the Joker. He was very much doing that scenario. So anyway, I looked at the release date this year for The Dark Knight Rises. And I saw something quite intriguing. Here you had, it was being released on July 20th. July 20th has two major anniversary coordinates around it. One is around space. It was the date when we landed on the moon, when Viking landed on Mars, and also it was the date that that Scotty on Star Trek died. So by coincidence, it had a lot of these space anniversaries. But the other clumping of anniversaries that I saw on that date concerned me. One was it was the date in which there was an assassination attempt against Hitler, Operation Valkyr, that was made into the movie. It also was the date in which Abdul I of Jordan was assassinated. He's well known as the main person that linked up with Lawrence of Arabia for those battles. Mm-hmm. And also was the date in 1977 in which the CIA released and admitted to the MK Ultra mind control.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah. So I found those intriguing. And then also, if I started going deeper, and I found that on July 22nd last year, July 22nd, 2011, was the date in which that man went on the island in Norway and machine-gunned, unfortunately, 77, mostly teenagers, to death. Well, July 22nd last year was also the release date for the movie Captain America that starts out with a scene of Nazis in Norway shooting to death many people. So I knew the violence that underlies The Dark Knight. I knew that the Joker was a very strong archetypal figure. And so I wondered aloud, and I said, I think on July 20th, we're going to have something extremely significant, important, and in many ways, you know, violent occurring on this date, connected to the release of this movie, The Dark Knight Rises. And, of course, a lot of us in America had been talking about this unique coincidence between the names of Bane, the villain in the movie, and Bane Capital with Romney. So, I mean, I didn't say it too much out loud, but Bane, I thought Bane could be the villain, you know, something that looked like Bane. And then what did we find on the 20th? The next day, as I mentioned this in my blog the next morning, I don't engage in psychic phenomena. I don't engage in woo-woo kind of material. I'm a Freudian. I'm very clear-cut. I like the data. I'm interested in unexplained phenomena, but I don't do ghost investigations. I don't do hauntings. I don't do psychic investigations. I leave that to others. But what occurred was on the morning of July 20th, all of a sudden, I woke up with a start because I thought there was someone in my bedroom calling out my name in a very definite male voice, in which I looked up expecting to see somebody standing over my bed. I thought it was that powerful. I looked at the time. It was 4:27 Eastern time. I immediately went to my computer, and I had all of these CNN and Google news alerts. Everybody was broadcasting quickly about the Aurora shooting at the midnight show. And I felt shaken. I felt, this is too much. This is, you know, I'm a futurist. I'm a predictor. I'm a perceiver, all of that. But to be so on target about the Aurora killings really did send me into a loop.
That's an incredible story. Now, how do you explain this, though, the signaling, the synchronicity, the messages in all this, the name coincidences? How do we begin to explain this? Where is this coming from? Why is it affecting human beings? These are big questions, of course, but let's try to tackle some of them.
Well, Hendrik, if I could explain them, I would be afraid of being a near godlike Viking or something, because I think that one of the things I'm not afraid to say is I don't know why my prediction was correct. I don't know why that I see these things and they keep coming to be. There's patterns here. There's harmonic signaling that's going on. I certainly am well-read, and I've actually spoken at JFK conferences because I've looked at the suicide of assassination eyewitnesses. And so I'm not afraid of conspiracy theories. I'm not afraid of talking about MK Ultra and hidden agendas and intelligence organizations that do things in plain sight.
Yep.
But I back away from quickly saying that there's such intelligence in the intelligence organizations that they're able to set up something like the Aurora shooting.
Right. No, I see what you mean. There's even though there might be foul play, which I, you know, highly suspect there's some kind of involvement, some kind of triggering or nudging along in the process, perhaps. We don't know how detailed this is. What you're saying is that all the details, all the pieces of this puzzle falling into place with the names, with the numbers, with the synchronicities, everything else, all of that cannot be planned. That's what you're saying.
Right. I think that what we as mere humans are looking for are patterns that are on a deeper level than even the CIA or,
yep,
or, you know, M5 or M6 can deal with.
Otherwise, we'd give them way too much credit, Lauren, right?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, if you want to call it the Great Spirit or God or a higher being, I don't know, or I don't know if it's part of the greater cosmos or some kind of... And sometimes I just think that we are ants, that we are mere ants, and we're trying to figure out the grass and the wind that may be going a certain direction, and we as mere humans are trying to perceive this. And so sometimes when I start looking at these patterns and noticing, you know, names that keep coming up, like the name Reeves, which keeps coming up in so many UFO cases, or the name Lafayette, which means little enchantment, or little fairy, that keeps getting so many strange stories connected to it. Is that, you know, because the Freemasons are so smart that they went around the country naming places that harmonically then would collect all of the energy of strange phenomena? Or is it the other way around, in which the Masons understood that there's some connection between certain names, and so they just gave the names, and then the phenomena comes there.
Right, you know, draw the energy to the site because of the placing and the naming of that site, right?
Right. I mean, I think the Masons tried to do that with how they set up the city plan of D.C., for instance, almost, or why obelisks are so important, and some of these symbols that keep coming up. Are they really there as magnets for the energy, as opposed to the other way around, that the Masons or the occults or the CIA or even James Holmes? Why did he pick? I mean, there's a rumor going around today saying that his original site for the shooting was New York City. He was going to go to the premiere of The Dark Knight Rises in New York City. And then for some reason, because he got paranoid and was frustrated by not getting a gun license or whatever, he decided on Aurora. And Aurora now, it has a very, very special name. And it's just something that you couldn't write into a novel, a synchronicity novel of any kind. Couldn't have this unless it's just beyond explaining. And I guess one of the things I know, 30 years ago, I would sit with families that had lost someone in a suicide. And one of the questions that I would hear over and over again is, why did Johnny do this? Why? And I see no difference in how the media or radio show host like yourself, in this question that always comes up, but why? Can you explain this? What's behind this? Almost as if there's some kind of magical, like it's a safe, and if we turn the dial in the right direction, it'll open the door of the safe and we'll be able to see in. I wish that was true, but I'm very dubious because it's just almost beyond human understanding.
Now, there's if this is some kind of, as I guess you kind of alluded to before, communication, it's a higher force in some way, maybe. This is pretty dark stuff, though, and the question I had about this, could it be then because it's, unfortunately, mostly only at these dark events, if you will, or horrendous massacres, that we on a mass scale only really pay attention to the details that they're coming through? Maybe it's true that the details are there all along, but it's just the fact that we don't examine them in that much close detail. So maybe, you know, there's different ways you can view this. But what's your take on this? Because if it's some kind of higher force playing through these events, then it certainly has chosen to do them at a pretty horrendous timing here, right?
Well, I think that humans looking for the answers are always caught in this cosmic battle between dark and light. And we as humans tend to notice the darkness that affects us in a way much more catastrophically. The media, you know, it is, and I mentioned this in my book, The Copycat Effect, the news is driven by stories that bleed.
Yeah.
You know, if it bleeds, it leads. So you have earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, assassinations, buildings collapsing. You know, in other words, one tragedy after another gets the news. The happy stories don't get readers, they don't get ratings, and you can see the trend in mass media as far as entertainment, movies. I remember when I was younger, and I've been a few decades on this earth, that you never saw movies that were slash and gore.
Mm-hmm.
You never saw horrible, horrible things on the screen like you see nowadays. I make the free will choice to avoid those, to not go to those movies. But it's obvious there's a large portion of the population that is drawn to these. So should we say that darkness is winning? Is the dark night rising? Is the elements of what some people would like to personify as Satan winning? I mean, how many good stories do you find, even in watching a little bit of the Olympics on TV and watching the headlines? It's not who is winning so much, it's who is failing. You know, the Americans not getting the medals, or the Greek woman who got kicked off a team.
Yeah.
And so even there, they're not celebrating accomplishments so much as emphasizing the negative. So what do we make of this then? What do we make of the fact that the signals are showing us the darkness? Now, let me just say, to balance this once again, I think that if you're a parent and you're naming your kid, you try to come up with names that sound hopeful. And you will notice that in naming children, most people will avoid a name like, I mean, how many Oswalds do you find anymore?
Right.
Yeah. Or, but a name like, for instance, Kira, which means sunshine. You know, people are picking out names, they're looking up definitions, and they're trying to give them their kids a leg up, a hopeful start. But then it gets all turned around. It gets turned around in which those people maybe that are checking names, where somebody, you know, has a middle name of Wayne, and the Waynes keep coming up as those people that, this has been, I'm not the only writer to mention this, that if you have a kid with the middle name Wayne, they tend to be, you know, killers and mass murderers and different things like that. And people are still naming their kids with the middle name Wayne. So I think that you're right. It looks like darkness is winning. I just want to say, I think that some people are trying to put light back in, and they're trying to live good lives, and we just don't hear about them as much because our way of communicating. Even I wonder about Twitter. I wonder about emails. I wonder about most websites. Are they really putting out there mostly the tragedies and the disasters and the, you know, I mean, what are the most popular YouTube? It's not of someone just normally walking down the street. It's of someone walking down the street and falling down.
Right. Yeah. It's a focus on the negative, on the dark stuff. Again, the drama is what lures man to it. The popularity is driven by tragedy in a way, and it's unfortunate. And we can, I mean, these are big questions. I want to return to some of these as well, Laura. And there was a few details as well I want to get in here in the first hour, and I want to ask if you heard about them, because they're pretty interesting. You mentioned briefly before, of course, his psychiatrist, James Holmes, Dr. Lynn Fenton. And she was reprimanded, I think it was a couple of years ago, for prescribing medication. to herself, her husband, and others, including Vicodin, Xanax, lorazepam, Ambien, and stuff like that. Some people, I mean, not flat out blaming her, of course, but just including the data, information in this, that there was someone who wasn't that responsible. And more interestingly, another thing I want to ask you about, his father, James Holmes' father, Robert Holmes, was set to testify on the unfolding Libor, the banking scandal, Libor scandal right now, which was just very interesting. Did you hear about this yet?
I hadn't heard about the father yet. I'd heard, you know, there's been lots of information about the mother who is a blue blood and goes back to the Mayflower, but I was wondering about the father.
Apparently there's some data here. I mean, John Holmes himself, he was into neuroscience. He was studying temporal manipulation, like how you can manipulate people's time perception and things like that. And there's a video that came out back from 2006 where he kind of makes a presentation about this in a kind of a shy, awkward way, I guess. But he's been into some interesting stuff. I mean, is this part of anything of this that's unfolding?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, now if we want to go into a whole different way of looking at James Holmes, first of all, about the psychiatrist, I think that if we look at any of our lives, many of us have made mistakes. You know, we pay for those mistakes, we, you know, do disciplinary or go to boards or whatever, you know, and they become minor mistakes in our lives. It's sort of like getting a speeding ticket, I mean, which is the only thing that James Holmes got before, but those are very minor, and we live through them, and we understand that we're all human, nobody's perfect. But the psychiatrist, unfortunately, if you're the psychiatrist of a mass murderer, every little thing you've ever done in your life gets magnified to become a Mount Everest. So the fact that she's given prescriptions to herself, to her husband, and to a friend, which are borderline unethical and illegal, and then she had to do some things about that, is now being blown greatly out of proportion to the crimes they would have been at the time. So we must understand that. The fact that James Holmes wrote a book or sent a notebook to her on July 12th that was never received and ended up in the mailroom, mm-hmm. That's not her fault.
Sure.
You know, it has nothing to do with her. It has everything to do with him. And it will be interesting if we ever get to see what's in that notebook. Was he telling about what he was going to do? Was he fantasizing about killing people? Or was it just random thoughts? So that's another thing. That has everything to do, once again, with him. I think that if we look at what's coming out this week about the prostitutes, the media is filled with interviews now with the different prostitutes that he used to satisfy his sexual needs. One of them is named Roxanne, which happens to mean dawn. One of them is you know, named Tiffany, and another's Monica. Monica means counselor. So Tiffany means manifest of God. So it's intriguing that the three people that have been interviewed that are prostitutes, and one was redhead, one was blonde, but the redhead said that he seemed obsessed with her red hair. And at one point, you know, in one meeting, he was nice. In another meeting with her, he was pulling her hair and being mean. And she describes him like a Jekyll and Hyde,
wow.
Which is all very interesting in terms of the neuroscience. There's one main point about James Holmes that I don't think has been emphasized enough. And so let me just bring it up about his psychology.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
In describing all of the school shooters, I said they were suicidal. One of the first things I noticed about James Holmes was he had full body armor on. He had a gas mask. His Joker outfit was underneath that. He looked like Bane overneath the Joker. But what did he do? He didn't get in a situation where he could die by suicide by cop. He did not shoot himself. He went back to his car, he dropped his guns, and he surrendered. He did not want to die. I think his diagnosis is much different than all of the differential diagnoses of school shooters, which tend to be much more personality disorders. His definitely seems to be a paranoid schizophrenic, early onset schizophrenia. He more closely resembles the Unabomber than he does the previous school shooters.
Ted Kaczynski, and we know he was fed doses with LSD and stuff like that, according to Hank Alberelli, who wrote that excellent book detailing some of that. Could there be anything like that here in this case, involvement with the military or something else?
Well, I think that one of the pieces that I've been getting together in my mind to write about is, even if we then not to blame the victim, and I want to make sure that people listening to this, I'm not talking about the victims being responsible for who they are, but if we look at the fact that of the 12 victims, four of them worked for the military in the psychological divisions and the psych and cyber ends of the military in the Aurora, Denver, Colorado area. To me, that is another signal from the beyond, or a signal that, you know, he was into neuroscience. He was doing this temporal manipulation. He put himself in the middle of a play, in the middle of Dark Knight Rising, in a way that I think is, we need to look at some of this. And then once again, I come back to this is the July 20th date and its overlap connection with MK Ultra. That to me just seemed beyond being a coincidence.
Yeah, indeed. And there's, again, more about his father here. That we can read a little bit more about this in the next hour, Lauren, as we continue. But he worked on different types of software machines. You know, it's called Corteronic, if I pronounce that correctly, neural networks, which would allow machines to interpret oral and visual stimuli to think like humans. His LinkedIn profile states that he worked for San Diego-based HNC Software Incorporated from 2000 to 2002. And that's where some of this research was done, which connected with DARPA, and it was there in the beginning of 98 to develop this. And it goes on from there. He also worked with HNC, as I mentioned before, merged with the Minneapolis-based Fair Isaac Corporation, the computer analysis and decision-making company. And he developed also software then that could potentially track a lot of the derivatives in the financial market, and here's how that connects to what I mentioned earlier, that he is one of these people who is going to testify against this unfolding now Libra scandal, one of the biggest ones in history. This is what it's been described as, basically tracing trillions of dollars that just vaporized here into thin air, and with this software they might have been able to track that. So that's just another, I don't know what we should call it. Coincidence? I don't know.
Right, exactly. Yes, I hadn't heard about this, but it's interesting. And I think the more that is unfolding, the more we're seeing the revealing of the methods, or, you know, sort of on a level that we can't really understand yet, because it's all these pieces of the puzzle that we need to put together.
Indeed. Now, I have so much more to ask you, Lauren, because this is very interesting. I want to ask you in the second hour a little bit more about how you think that some of this potentially could be, how, if there's a way to start, you know, going away from the focus on the darkness again. I mean, partially so far we're blaming the media a lot for this as well, which is absolutely understandable considering how this has been unfolded and presented in a certain way in the media. I'm going to ask you more about that in the next hour, though. But before we proceed, let's talk about your blog and, of course, your book. The Copycat Effect. It's available on Amazon, and I definitely recommend people also to check out Lauren's blog, copycateffect.blogspot.com. com for much more of this type of material. You follow along in the story. You have a bunch of this on James Holmes, and also, of course, that post from the 19th of July, then the day before, and you did end the whole post with saying what's going to happen tomorrow or on the 20th. I mean, that's really interesting, right there.
Yeah, and I'm noticing that the media does not track the copycat effect very well. They're very forgetful. They maybe mentioned that there's one. Some of them mentioned there's been three. Actually, I posted last night that there's been 9 copycat incidents since the 20th.
Oh boy, yeah, it's really disturbing. Now, the book again. Is there anything else you want to mention about that? It's linked up on your blog, correct? Or where can we go to find that? Amazon.com primarily.
Yeah, the copycat effect is it's easily available online. It's also mentioned at the bottom of my Twilight Language blog, which is at the copycat effect address you gave. But people can just type in Twilight Language and they can find me, because it's become a quite popular site for people to visit in the last 10 days, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly, unfortunately. Right, copycateffect.blogspot.com. Stay with us, Lauren. We'll be right back with more after a short break. Have a member section where the second half of our interviews are available. Most of our programs are 2 hours, and most of these are available in our member section. If you want to acquire membership, if you haven't already, please go to our website, redicecreations.com, and click on subscribe to learn more. It's quick, easy. Just follow the instruction and get instant access to all our archives with radio going back to 2006, plus video material, commentaries, music, and much more. We're a commercial-free radio program, and we are listener-supported, so if you like what we do and want to hear more, do consider getting a 3-month subscription and try it out. It's just €5 per month. In the second hour, we're going to begin discuss how media can trigger events. Lauren comments on the popular lone nut idea constantly used by the media. Then he puts on the conspiracy hat and discusses more synchronicities and oddities surrounding James Holmes and the Aurora event, including the possibility that James did not work alone. Coleman also converses on the Batman movies and confusing themes within them. We'll talk about violent projections of our current culture and defenses from dark programming. Later, we talk about the movie Red Dawn and discuss more symbolism in relation to the Aurora phenomenon. Coleman ends talking about the aftermath in Colorado, and around America. Don't miss our continuation with Lauren Coleman. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Linda Moulton Howe. Then Peter Lindberg from the Ocean X team will be joining us. After this, Daniel Pinchbeck, Jan Irvin, William A. Gardner, Mark Grant, Rosa Corey, Walter Burian, Randall Carlson, Joel Gilbert, Ron Keller, Charles Upton, Freeman and Jamie, and we also have Joseph Atwill with Fritz Heed and Niola Sparkis joining us. But right now, we'll proceed with the second hour together with Lauren Coleman.